Skilled workers from outside the province are also on their way to Pimichickamack to help with water and electrical issues. And Monia says a U.S. company has reached out about sending a portable water plant to the First Nation. It's not the first time Pimichickamack residents were forced to leave their reserve. Many were forced to go south twice because of wildfires. I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Indigenous peoples across the U.S. have been swept up in the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented immigrants. Gabriel Pietrazio reports an Arizona tribe is taking steps to safeguard its tribal members.
Thank you for calling the Hualapai Tribe's message line, where we encourage you to report any encounters with ICE agents.
The Hualapai Tribe near Kingman has set up a hotline.
Please leave your name and contact information, as well as the date, location, and a brief description of the incident. All information received will be checked and documented by tribal administration.
Hualapai Chairman Dwayne Clark is urging members to remain calm and always carry their tribal ID cards with them. His administration is also pledging to aid its 2,300 members in verifying their identity should they be held by federal authorities. This comes in the aftermath of a fatal shooting by an ICE agent in Minneapolis, also where four members of a South Dakota tribe have been detained. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Glad to have you with us here in the KBOO Evening News on this Thursday, January 15th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The U.S. pledges new aid to the United Nations, but with a warning and exceptions. Israeli politics, repression and corruption. And while Putin stalls on peace talks, questions about the Russian economy and society multiply. First, the U.S. pledges new aid to the United Nations, but with a warning and exceptions. The Trump administration has pledged $2 billion in humanitarian assistance to U.N. agencies, far short of previous foreign aid commitments. And the pledge came with this warning from the State Department, quote, "The agreement requires the U.N. to consolidate humanitarian functions to reduce bureaucratic overhead, unnecessary duplication, and ideological creep. Individual UN agencies will need to adapt, shrink, or die," unquote. The money will not go to those agencies, but to just one, a pooled fund under the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. Doing so may give the U.S. leverage to see that aid goes only to countries of interest to it, a possibility that some aid experts say politicizes humanitarian aid and puts the nail in the coffin of it. The UN's OCHA office nevertheless welcomed the U.S. aid. The United States was the leading funder of the UN's humanitarian efforts in 2025, nevertheless, with about $3.38 billion, or about 14.6% of the global sum, according to UN data. That was down sharply, however, from the past decade, when it regularly contributed a third or more of the annual total. The fund reductions in the USAID program have taken a heavy toll in medical help for AIDS, malaria, and other health crises, especially in Africa. Consider the USAID measured against a $1 trillion military budget that Trump on X said should be $1.5 trillion. 17 countries are at the top of the USAID list, and they include Sudan, Syria, Haiti, Ukraine, and Honduras. But the list leaves out Gaza, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The Gaza omission is significant since Israel has decided to block 37 non-governmental organizations from providing aid to Gaza and ordered the foreign groups to leave the country. The NGOs include Doctors Without Borders and Oxfam, as well as several Israeli aid organizations. Israel claims that, quote, security reviews revealed that employees of certain organizations were involved in terrorist activity, in particular Doctors Without Borders, an extraordinary claim. The liberal newspaper Haaretz reported that, quote, a consortium of 19 Israel-based human rights NGOs condemned Israel's ban of dozens of international aid groups in Gaza. The UK, Canada, France, Japan, and several other countries expressed serious concerns about the renewed deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Gaza, which remains catastrophic. Israeli politics, repression, and corruption. As the healthcare crisis deepens in Gaza, the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, has clarified that Israel will not build settlements there after all, saying it will establish communities in the Strip when the time is right. But U.S. officials seem wedded to the Kushner plan for making Gaza into a glitzy, AI-run resort area. It's a perfect example of the criticism leveled by Harvard's Sarah Roy. She has written that, quote, Israel has thwarted the viable development of the Gaza Strip with the primary goal of precluding the establishment of a Palestinian state by weakening, if not eliminating, the economic foundation on which it could be built, unquote. The situation, meantime, in the West Bank is equally tenuous for Palestinians. Israel has given approval for 19 more West Bank settlements as violence against Palestinians increases. Defense Minister Katz said Israel is, quote, implementing a policy of de facto sovereignty in the West Bank. It is impossible now, he said, due to the circumstances, to declare annexation. Practical annexation means evacuating the Palestinians from the terror camps and stationing the Israeli Defense Forces there and establishing settlements, unquote. On the political front, corruption continues to taint the Netanyahu government. It approved a bill that would give it power over the mandate and composition of a commission of inquiry into the events of October 7. That commission, according to sources, will investigate protests against the government's attempted judicial coup. Israel's attorney general called the bill riddled with fundamental flaws. Meantime, Netanyahu is embroiled in another scandal called Qatargate, in which aides, and possibly Netanyahu himself, are accused of accepting money from Qatar during the war with Hamas, painting Qatar as a friendly country. Iranian hackers say they have broken into the cell phone of Netanyahu's top aide and found evidence of the Qatar connection. Our third top story. While Putin stalls on peace talks, questions about the Russian economy and society multiply. If you are Vladimir Putin, you probably think the objective of defeating Ukraine is close at hand. You are slowly gaining more territory. Your constant bombing of Ukraine's energy facilities is going to create a bad winter. And you have Trump's key negotiator, Steve Witkoff, in your pocket. You therefore are going to keep negotiating peace terms and pretending an interest in a settlement, but your emphasis will remain on gaining more Ukrainian territory. As one analyst quoted in the New York Times puts it, quote, for the Kremlin, discussing the Trump peace plan is purely a tactical game played with the U.S. to maintain constructive relations with the current American president, while simultaneously provoking friction and contradictions between the U.S. and Ukraine. The latest displays of Putin's direction are his rejection of a European military presence in Ukraine after a settlement, and Russia's use of a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile in attacks on Ukraine. The presence of a European peacekeeping force is an essential element of post-war security for Ukraine. A Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman warned, however, that, quote, the deployment of military units, military facilities, warehouses, and other infrastructure of Western countries on Ukrainian territory will be classified as foreign intervention, posing a direct threat to the security of not only Russia, but also other European countries. She added, quote, all such units and facilities will be considered legitimate combat targets of the Russian armed forces. The firing of the Oreshnik hypersonic missile close to Russia's border with Poland was surely intended to send that very message, that European forces stationed in Ukraine would be fair game. The missile may also have been intended to let the Trump administration know that Russia's bombing of Ukraine is unrelenting so long as its terms for peace are not met. There are, however, ominous signs that Putin may prefer not to notice. British intelligence has been at the forefront of those observers who see Russia's territorial gains as minimal and its economic and soldiers' losses as major. More than 1 million soldiers have been killed or wounded. Other observers report on a fraying society and weakening economy. The Washington Post, for instance, reported December 30th that, quote, inside the country, fatigue and resentment are festering beneath the suppression of dissent. There is no outlet for public frustration and no relief from the mounting national exhaustion with a nearly 4-year-long war that is corroding the country from within and making society more dysfunctional. In other news, Trump deepens U.S. intervention in Iran. Amidst a communications blackout and mounting casualty figures from the nationwide protests in Iran, at least 2,000 dead, with thousands more jailed, Trump's threatening rhetoric expands. He is encouraging the demonstrators to carry on, assuring them that the U.S. has their back. Iranian patriots, keep protesting. Take over your institutions, he says. Help is on its way. If a protester is executed, as may have happened already, Trump is promising retribution. He's evidently more concerned about killing of Iranian protesters than American ones. Trump has apparently rejected an Iranian proposal to resume talks on Iran's nuclear program. He has already announced a 25% tariff on countries that do business with Iran and trade with the United States. But he seems determined to make another show of force, buoyed by the easy win in Venezuela, no doubt. How another round of U.S. bombing will help the protesters and promote democracy in Iran has yet to be spelled out. The Ayatollah Khamenei has vowed to attack Israel and U.S. bases in the region if the U.S. attacks Iran again. China sends mixed signals on strategic weapons. To judge from recent research, China is strengthening its defense against long-range missiles and slowing its strategic weapons production. On one hand, China's weapons show at its October National Day celebration included new missile defense weapons. On the other, China is said by the Pentagon to be producing fewer nuclear weapons, though still engaged in a massive nuclear expansion with no appetite for arms control discussions, according to the Pentagon. China's strategic plan thus looks remarkably similar to that of the United States in the Reagan era. What also merits attention is the Pentagon's adoption of new language to define China's nuclear strategy. Where once China was a pacing challenger to the U.S., now it is said to be engaged in a, quote, logical nuclear weapons program that reflects its size and influence. That shift may reflect Trump's latest attempt to find common ground with Xi Jinping. The U.S. bars European hate speech regulators. In 2022, the European Union passed a law called the Digital Services Act that requires social media companies to meet transparency standards and to remove certain racist, anti-Semitic, and violent content if it violates national laws. The Trump administration sees the Digital Service Act as an attempt to force American platforms to censor speech globally, an allegation European officials deny. At the end of 2025, the administration issued a statement on what it calls the global censorship industrial complex and barred 5 speech regulators from entering the U.S. on the grounds that they were radical activists. In fact, they were regulating hate speech, disinformation, and anti-vaccination content. One of the online sources that was cited by the EU regulators and fined $140 million was Elon Musk's X. Trump has jumped to his defense and to the defense of other social media that are increasingly lax in regulating hate speech and conspiracy theories. French, German, and other European officials struck back, arguing that once again the U.S. was interfering in European affairs. Quote, "We will not be intimidated by a government that uses accusations of censorship to silence those who stand up for human rights and freedom of expression," two German officials said. Next, the U.S. exits 66 international organizations. The Trump administration has announced that it will withdraw the United States from 66 international organizations, most of them affiliated with the UN. Foremost among the withdrawals is from the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the bedrock climate change treaty that was ratified by the Senate in 1992. Other UN-sponsored organizations concerned with climate are also on the list. The U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Accords on climate change will be final on January 20th. Trump's main reasons for withdrawing are that these organizations are stifled by bureaucracy, have a progressive ideology, and act contrary to U.S. interests. Deeper reasons are that these are multilateral groups that focus on scientific facts, meaning the U.S. can't dominate them and control their findings. Gene Galbraith, a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, says of these U.S. withdrawals that they send a major signal around the world of U.S. disdain for climate policy that's essential for the world. Big Oil is not all in on investing in Venezuela. The major oil companies are throwing a monkey wrench into Trump's planned takeover of Venezuela's oil. The CEO for Exxon declared during a meeting of oil company executives with Trump that Venezuela's oil industry is uninvestable because Venezuela lacks the legal framework to ensure the safety of investments. Trump told the executives that, quote, "We're going to be making the decision on which companies invest. You're dealing with us directly. You're not dealing with Venezuela at all. We don't want you to deal with Venezuela," unquote. True to form, Trump said he will probably keep Exxon out of Venezuela. As for the rest, Trump will probably try to strong-arm them by arguing that he has given the oil and gas industries all kinds of incentives at the expense of wind and solar energy. But with oil prices low per barrel these days, companies will not find pumping more oil into the market very profitable. Finally, these updates. First, from Nigeria. The Trump administration's air attack on ISIS enclaves has turned out to be a dud, according to people on the ground there. Some of the explosives did not explode, and those that did were apparently off target and hit bare ground. But as with the attack on Iran's nuclear facilities that supposedly obliterated them, this administration will declare success when the evidence shows otherwise. And on Greenland, for those who believe in self-determination, this joint statement by Greenland's political parties should, but won't, end Trump's threats to take over the territory. Quote, "We do not want to be Americans. We do not want to be Danes. We want to be Greenlanders. The future of Greenland must be decided by the Greenlandic people. We would like to emphasize once again our wish that the United States' contempt for our country ends." That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Lizard. It's not uncommon for the same people who show up at No War on Venezuela protests to also participate in pro-Palestine protests. What are the similarities between Venezuela and Palestine? Adrian Pine is a non-resident scholar at UC Riverside's Latino Studies Center. KABU contributor David Rosenberg spoke with her about what she sees as a deep link between the Israeli assault on Palestine and U.S. policy toward Venezuela.
Palestine and Venezuela, what do they have to do with each other? They're in other parts of the world, and they seem to be very different situations. What do they have in common?
Palestine and Venezuela have so much in common. First of all, we have to keep in mind Israel's policy since its foundation of really interfering in other states' affairs with the aim of installing governments that will be supportive of the Zionist project, of, you know, a genocidal project toward Palestinians. And so that includes arming and training the Guatemalan genocide in the 1980s with, you know, Elliot Abrams being the intermediary between Rios Montt and the Israelis. It includes various coups, working directly with Nazis like Klaus Barbie in Bolivia in the coup, the cocaine coup in 1980. It includes, you know, supporting the Argentinian dictatorship, which, of course, another fascist project in which a higher proportion of Jewish Argentinians were being tortured and disappeared than other ethnicities, and still, you know, reaching out to ensure the implementation of dictatorships that would then in turn support Israel. My colleague Majid Shihadeh refers to this as global Israel.
Remember the case of Jacobo Timmerman down there too. Yeah.
I mean, so many of really the revolutionary Argentinians who gave their lives were also Jewish. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind. This has not been different in Venezuela. If we look at the Israel-Venezuela relationships over the years, what we see is that prior to Chavez, it was exceptionally strong. Chavez maintained relations with Israel for his first years in power, but after after one of the major attacks on Gaza, he broke relations with Israel in around 2009. And there's a famous speech of his saying, you know, "Damn Israel, maldito sea Israel," like damn Israel for, you know, these violent acts that it is, you know, that it is carrying out. And so at that point, Venezuela, under Bolivarian Venezuela, under Chavez, became one of the staunchest allies of the Palestinian people. Now, it's no coincidence that the Nobel Peace Prize winner, the fascist Maria Corina Machado, in, I believe it was 2019, her party, Vente Venezuela, a fascist Venezuelan party that does not
even conservative, but fascist.
Fascist. They formed an official alliance with the Likud party, Netanyahu's party in Israel. And she has repeatedly congratulated Israel on its genocide against Palestinians. One of the first people who congratulated her after winning the Nobel Peace Prize was Netanyahu. And of course, we should recall that she dedicated that prize to Donald Trump. So we see, you know, the right wing of Venezuela is about as Zionist as, you know, as you could get. And so the projects are intertwined. I mean, this really is Israel trying to produce, I would say, structural Palestinians around the world in order to ensure the installation of dictatorships that that strip people's indigenous peoples of their sovereignty, that strip nations of their sovereignty in favor of the Zionist project. Now, there are many other types of overlap. You know, you see also, we can take an example of the tanker that was pirated in early December in the Caribbean Ocean that was bringing much needed Venezuelan oil to Cuba that had been bought and paid for, that the U.S. simply boarded and stole. They then brought that to Corpus Christi, and it went to the Valero refinery, and that is where nearly 100% of the JP-8 fuel that is what Israel uses in its aerial bombardments as part of the genocide is produced. You know, so we see these very direct connections, the same corporations profiting off of the violence against the Venezuelan people and the violence against people in Palestine, Chevron in particular, but also the sale of Citgo recently, the Venezuelan oil company, was recently sold to a Zionist billionaire, major AIPAC supporter. And so he's going to benefit tremendously, as will Israel, from these illegal actions that have taken place, that are carried out, you know, just tremendous violations of sovereignty and international law that very much parallel the way that Israel has been acting with, you know, the full U.S. support against Palestine.
I recall that decades ago, Israel started to train police forces and militaries in Latin America. And that was true in Venezuela, you're saying?
Yes. And of course, we have to remember that's also true in the United States. So just as...
Well, police forces, yeah.
Yeah. The police that, you know, that are killing people. I mean, I know ICE is a different story. There's no training there, apparently. But the police forces in the United States are trained and in many cases equipped with technologies that have been developed to repress Palestinians. So technologies like the LRADs, the long-range acoustic devices, which are used to disperse crowds and create incredibly painful sound.
Remember that book by Anthony Lowenstein, was it? About Palestine as a laboratory for Israel?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's others who have written very eloquently about that as well, including Todd Miller. And exactly, that's what has happened. Israel has tested all of these and developed all these incredibly violent technologies for use to control Palestinians, to control this population, this sovereign and indigenous population. And they have made billions of dollars marketing it around the world. This is one of the things we saw in the Epstein files, that Epstein himself was facilitating and should be just as scandalous as his other horrific crimes, was the sale of technologies of repression to foreign governments. So including Ivory Coast, for example, once these technologies are sold, these governments are locked into this relationship with Israel, regardless of who might win at the polls, you know, in the subsequent election. And then Israel has greater control over increasing numbers of populations around the world in order to ensure its genocidal project at home.
And when you hear these companies discuss, it's often in terms of the stock market. Aren't they good investments?
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I would say from a capitalist perspective, they probably are, right? You know, genocide is profitable. And if that's going to be their measure of good and bad, then, you know, we need, as people who care about humanity, to challenge.
We need an ethical restart or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and would you say that the solidarity movements for Palestine and Venezuela are closely linked, that the same people who would support one would support the other?
Absolutely. There's been tremendous clarity on this from within Palestine. You know, I've seen numerous organizations coming out with statements in solidarity with Venezuela. Also, you know, various statements and mobilizations throughout the Arab world as well that are making those connections. But Venezuelans themselves are making this connection. We're seeing in the protests here in the United States, I went to the protests outside of the White House the day of the illegal kidnapping and violent bombing of Venezuela, and kidnapping of the president and the Congress member, Celia Flores, his spouse. I went to the White House for a protest. And it was really impressive how many people showed up on 11 hours, you know, 11 hours after the kidnapping itself, which says a lot. And almost all of the speakers were making those links between what is happening in Palestine and this atrocious violation of sovereignty and of human lives that has just taken place in Venezuela. I think the connections are impossible to ignore, especially for the people who have been out on the streets, who have been organizing in different ways, who have been, you know, organizing through BDS, through all of the different actions that we can take for the past few years. I mean, it's impossible not to see the connections between that imperialist genocidal aggression and this one.
That was retired American University anthropology professor Adrian Pine speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO's Zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue featuring KBOO's programming.